Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight into how it affects our national deterrence. We hope you enjoy this show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the Nuclear View, where we talk about current issues and topics and discuss really interesting articles that we've read over the week before. And this week, our topic is one that I'm sure you've been reading about in the newspaper lately, and that, of course, is NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, turned 75. It was on April 4th, 1949, that the North Atlantic Treaty was signed by the 12 original member states of NATO. And of course, now we're actually a few weeks late in our well wishing of happy birthday, but we're getting around to it. And of course, I'm joined by Curtis today, Curtis McGiffin. Jim is off preparing for the hardened electronics and radiological technologies. I think that's what HART stands for.
Better than I would have done.
Yeah, the HART conference, which is next week. And so it's just Curtis and I. And Curtis, were you going to sing happy birthday to NATO? Was that the plan?
Absolutely not.
Oh, okay. So no happy birthday happy birthday to Jens Stoltenberg or anybody else. Well, I suppose, but we do probably need to talk about NATO's past, NATO's present, and then, you know, the future of NATO. So let me throw it over to you, being the old guy in the room who was, you know, ostensibly at NATO when it was founded. So
you're going to give me all of Jim's jokes. Huh?
I'm going to give you all of Jim's jokes today. So if we go back to the original formation of NATO, of course, you know, we look to the late 1940s at the, you know, after World War II, the West was concerned about Soviet expansion, and they were also concerned, you know, they were concerned about the economic revitalization of Europe. And the formation of NATO, you know, which is ostensibly, it's, you know, it's a mutual defense organization, that's its purpose, was this fear. And if you go back to the history of the period and you look at, for example, Czechoslovakia, where there was essentially a coup that toppled the government. You know, if you look at what happened in Poland and you look at these countries where there were Soviet occupation forces, the democratic governments, the free governments, even they were sort of one by one picked off and replaced by communist regimes. Of course, the Soviets had nothing to do with it. It was all domestic and, you know, it was just the natural state of affairs. But Western Europe was, you know, reasonably concerned that what might happen to them. So we ended up with the North Atlantic Treaty Organization that is, you know, now, back then it was 12 original members, mostly Northwest Europe and the United States and Canada. And then now we've gone from 12 members, we're up to 32. And then, of course, we also have Bosnia and Herzegovina, Georgia, and Ukraine are aspiring members, so they have their own status. And then, of course, there are 18 countries that participate in NATO's Partnership for Peace. One of those countries is somebody that you're all familiar with, Vladimir Putin and the Russian Federation are members in the Partnership for Peace, although they're not, you know, doing that particularly well.
Not very peaceful, is it?
No, And just for further clarification, the NATO member countries, and I think this is kind of relevant and useful information for today. So the NATO member countries have a combined population of 967 million people. So why the Russians would want to pick a fight with NATO, I'm not sure. They also have a combined 3.5 million soldiers, military personnel, and they spend about $1.2 trillion in total defense dollars, which is all something that Russia just can't match. But that's NATO today. And, of course, we've talked about NATO's history. What do you think the listeners probably need to know, Curtis, that, you know, I haven't mentioned thus far? What else is there about NATO before we move to the present and future of NATO? Is there anything else about sort of the history of NATO that we really ought to provide as background?
Yeah, Adam, thanks. You said this is another great episode. I'm not sure how great it is. It's just you and me, but we'll get it through here. Hey, I wanted to add to those great stats you had. I believe the EU, the European Union, not necessarily NATO. There are a few countries that are in one and not in the other. But yeah, it's probably roughly the same. About $14 trillion GDP, annual GDP. Making the EU collectively, I think, the third or fourth largest economy in the world. So there's definitely a lot of capability and capacity there within that European theater. You know, we are celebrating the diamond anniversary of NATO. I think that's something that is interesting, because to get 12 to 32 countries with individual interests and individual cultures, and in some cases, individual languages, to all sort of come together for a specific purpose, I think is a celebratory effort in and of itself. But let's talk about the alliance in this sense. You're spot on with your observations there. In 1949, I think it really worked hand in hand with the Marshall Plan. Many folks out there believe the Marshall Plan was meant to be to rebuild the European economy so that they would be a good trading partner for the United States going, you know, post-World War II. And that certainly was a benefit. But the purpose of the Marshall Plan was to ensure that these economies were built quickly and so that these European nations wouldn't become socialists and fall into the hands of other collectivist sort of mentalities. And sort of to instill that capitalistic idea, and to which, you know, democracies and whatnot are built around. Note that the this transatlantic alliance was, you know, formed in an effort to preserve peace, stability, and security. And we often refer to NATO as collective defense. I don't like that term. I would refer to this as collective deterrence. This is the value of the Article 5 rule is the value of its collective deterrence. The fear that if I go to war with one country, I go to war with all 32 is an incredible deterrent, with or without nuclear weapons, as you mentioned, 3.5 million troops in uniform. Almost a billion people in population. So this is no easy task for Russia, which is a population of about 149 million, to try to usurp and replace. So I would think that there is much to be done in that consideration. Now, NATO, of course, spurred a Russian reaction, a Soviet reaction, with the creation of the Warsaw Pact on 14 May 1955. And that's, all of a sudden we say, well, we needed NATO to parry the Warsaw Pact. Actually, it was the other way around, right? Just looking at the dates. So something that was very interesting there. Speaking about Article 5, Article 5 was only enacted once. Yes. Adam, do you know what that was? It's your trivia question of the day. What was the only time Article 5 was invoked?
After the United States was attacked on September 11th, 2001.
Absolutely. On 12 September 2001, NATO Article 5 was invoked. Ironically, for an attack on the United States and not in Europe. So just something to take note of there. So a lot of things have been going on. Much of us and our audience is probably more interested in the present and in the future than we are necessarily in the past. The past is what it was. I think NATO is a complete success in that regard. Now, NATO expansion, if we want to look at the past, Adam, NATO expansion, of course, has some controversies to it. Give me your thoughts on whether or not NATO expansion was right, wrong, or indifferent.
Yeah, see, this is one of the problems, and we're thinking about it in terms of like Ukraine, for example. Ukraine wants to become a part of NATO, and if I were you know the president of the Ukraine, I would want to be part of NATO too, because I clearly know that the Russians have no intention of allowing me to sort of look to the West and become culturally and otherwise tied to the West. They want me, Ukraine, tied to Russia. And so in thinking about Ukraine, if you think back to the years after the demise of the Soviet Union, you know, it's the evidence is kind of mixed, but I think it's probably true that James Baker, the former Secretary of State for George H.W. Bush, told Gorbachev that, you know, the U.S., that NATO would not move further east than a reunified Germany. That's sort of the what's perceived as what was said, although there was never any sort of written agreement. This was a verbal statement. And I think there seems to be good evidence that that's true. And then, of course, we eventually, by the mid to late 90s, we start getting the addition of former East Bloc countries into NATO up and through the 2000s. And I guess, as I think about it, you know, for example, one of our good friends, Michaela Dodge, she's Czech. And the Czechs despise the Russians because of what the Russians did to the Czechs during, you know, the Cold War. And if you think to many of these former East Bloc countries, they have a lot of animosity towards the Russians. And it's, you know, justifiable animosity. And so you can't help but think that it's understandable for these countries, regardless of what we may have promised the Russians, that these countries would clamor to join a union with a group that would help protect them against their longtime rival and, you know, in their own eyes, their abuser. And so it's hard to say, well, you know, we made this promise to Mikhail Gorbachev that we wouldn't move east. And so therefore, you know, we need to keep all these countries neutral because, you know, when the East European plain opens up, the Russians really need room to push their troops forward and then fall back before Moscow, which is what the Russians want. They want room to fall back and to attrit, you know, the Western forces. That's sort of the Russian fear. But these countries don't want that. They don't want to be that sort of room for that to happen. So how can you blame them for wanting to be a part of NATO? I just can't blame them for wanting that and wanting to turn west and turn towards, you know, what we would generally think of as liberal values and free markets and those types of aspirations. So how do you say no? And how do you say no for a very sort of realpolitik reason of we don't want to make the Russians mad?
Well, I think you're right. You know, I think states have the right to self-determine, something that we espouse. And if they determine it's in their national interest to be in an alliance such as this, then there would be a place for them and a place that they would feel they'd want to be in. I think some of the states have seen what NATO or what agreements with the West that aren't if you will, guaranteed by some sort of lawful treaty, mean like the Budapest Memorandum and how that's impacted the Ukraine today. And I firmly believe that's one of the reasons why Finland and maybe even Sweden decided to leave their decades of neutrality and become part of NATO, in that, yes, the threat has gotten worse, and it is a second and third order effect of Putin's actions. That's something he probably didn't plan on happening, that has certainly made his strategic position worse. But I think part of the decision-making process was, hey, we are not going to rely on this Partnership for Peace program. We need to be sheltered under the Article 5 lawful protection, because we want to make sure that, in fact, the Americans and others will actually be there when the time comes. And so getting under the NATO umbrella seems to be something that benefited them. And so off we go, right? And so now we have this issue, right, that we're dealing with this cost and what it means. And we've seen a lot of debate, Adam, about, you know, whether or not NATO is fulfilling its promise. You mentioned how much defense budget collectively NATO is, and it clearly it overshadows a dwarfing Russian defense budget. Of course, purchase power parity would play a role in that, in making up for some of that gap. But it's already a big gap, and most of the NATO nations aren't paying their 2%, which is a promise that wasn't made in 1949. That promise wasn't made until 2006.
Really? And that's when that originated. I don't think I knew when that was I've just always assumed it.
Yeah. But. Yeah. We always assumed it. I think during the Cold War, it was just sort of assumed you'd give all you could. But post-Cold War, there was a need to really figure out who's doing what, right? And so we get into 2006 at the Wales. I forget which summit it was, but they get in here and they talk about, we'll set the minimum of 2% of their GDPs to set as defense spending, and then this promise is remade in 2014. After the invasion of Crimea, under the Wales summit, in response to the illegal annexation of Crimea, we see something called the Defense Investment Pledge come into play here, where the allies agree not only to continue to meet their 2% guideline, which many were not at that point, but now they set a defense spending of 20% of their annual defense expenditure is supposed to be for new equipment by 2024. So within 10 years of when they had this agreement. So obviously that solved all the problems, right? Because this is a great alliance and everybody is all rowing the canoe in the same direction. Oh no. In 2023, of course, after Putin invades Ukraine for the second time, in 2023, the Vilnius summit, NATO leaders agreed to the new defense investment pledge. They say new; it's one that they had already done in ensuring a commitment to investing at least 2% of their GDP. Okay, so they're still making the same; they're still re-promising to do the same thing, right? And they also affirmed in many cases that expenditure beyond 2% will be needed in order to remedy existing shortfalls. Oh. There's existing shortfalls in 2023.
Yeah.
And then the need in order to remedy those existing shortfalls across all domains arising from a more contested security order. Well, that's a polite way of saying all hell's breaking loose in Eastern Europe, and it's time for us to pay attention and make investments, right? And so they agree to this pledge again, to the 20% guideline on major new equipment. And so they're estimating by the end of this year, 2024, that two-thirds of the allies are expected to meet or exceed the 2%. Two-thirds. It's not two-thirds now, but they're saying by the end, they'll get to So again, this is a commitment that all the allies made in 2006, so roughly 18 years ago, and of which a third will still have not met or fulfilled that promise. And yet this is an alliance that is supposed to be extremely important and of everyone's national interest. And so when we look back at President Obama's complaints about free riders in NATO, President Trump's effort to convince NATO that they need to pay their fair share, and even in the Biden administration saying, hey, you guys need to pony up and get in there. All this goes to add one last thing, Adam, and I'm going to hand it back to you, and that is that when you fail to pay your bills at the 2% level, you set a status quo, right? So now what happens? What happens when you start actually meeting that 2% goal? What does that look like to the adversary?
Yeah.
It looks like you're spending a ton of money to go to war with them. That's their perspective. And so it looks provocative. And this is why it's always important never to take a break in your standard operating procedure, because status quo allows you to continue to do the things you need to do, regardless of how hot the geopolitical situation might be.
Yeah, it's a good point. And what it sort of shows me is here we are, we're more than 2 years into the war in Ukraine. And we've seen how many nuclear threats against NATO specifically. And the one country that has really and truly responded has been Poland. Mm-hmm. They are, they're spending roughly 4.5% of their GDP on defense. But I'm still shocked that even the Baltic states, who are, I think they're all over 2%,
they're just
over 2%. Whereas you would think countries that feel the most threat would be the ones to spend the most. Whereas, the U.S. still dwarfs every individual country in Europe in its spending just on European security. And so I sort of wonder what it takes for Europe. And this goes back to World War II. I often wonder, did Europe at the end of World War II essentially extinguish itself in the sense that was that Second World War sort of, it took all of the, I don't know if you want to call it the spirit out of Europe, but it's been a challenge since, because, you have, every country in Europe, with maybe Poland, maybe a couple others, they have large welfare states, and the vast majority of governmental spending is on social programs. And now you're essentially saying, hey, you're going to have to transfer some of that. And their economies have all been stagnant. And this is one of the lessons I would hope Americans learn, is that you cannot grow your economy the more you spend on social welfare. It goes the opposite way. The more you spend on social welfare, the lower the growth. And so, if European countries get a 1% growth rate, for them, that's not too bad. Whereas for the U.S., we expect a 3-4% growth rate. That's a good growth rate. And so if you look at global growth, most of it is in Asia. And it's in countries, China, India, other places where they don't have these extensive social welfare programs that have a lot of effects. And so part of what I wonder about the future is, where is the money going to come from? Where will the soldiers, sailors, and airmen come from that will essentially staff the militaries of European nations? And, where will the funding come from? Because, Europe isn't growing. One of the things, when you have really high taxes, there's an inverse relationship between the tax rates and birth rates. The higher taxes are, the lower birth rates are. So they're not having children. They're not growing. But yet they're going to supposedly, spend more on defense, and they're going to grow their militaries. And I just see them in a very, very difficult position to make that happen. Now, well, I want their success.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And to add to that, I mentioned that their GDP is roughly $14 trillion. That has not increased very much in the last 18 years, whereas America's GDP, which around the 2008 timeframe was the same as the EU's, is now $29 trillion-ish. And so so their lack of growth has really impeded their ability to do these other things, as I think that they are concerned with. Now, NATO does a lot of things, and I'm not going to get into all their operations. I think their air policing is probably one of the most interesting in how they utilize that sort of thing. But let's remember, Adam, you know, we're the NIDS view, and we tend to talk a lot about nuclear things. And so, you know, NATO says that, quote, nuclear weapons are a core component of NATO's overall capabilities for defense and deterrence alongside conventional and missile defense forces. NATO is committed to arms control, disarmament, and nonproliferation, but as long as nuclear weapons exist, it will remain a nuclear alliance. You know, and we know that we have a few European nations that have some heartburn with nuclear weapons, don't want them in their countries and those sorts of things, but don't seem to mind being part of the nuclear of the nuclear alliance. Interesting. Finland has been quite vocal at its embracing of the nuclear alliance. Very interesting. In fact, Putin just recently pontificated some statement that said if NATO nuclear weapons wind up in Finland, that would be a problem for them, that they would have to resist in some manner. My words, not theirs. And another quote here from the NATO website that I wanted to share with our listeners is that, quote, the strategic forces of the alliance, and particularly those of the United States, are the supreme guarantee of the security of the alliance, unquote. And so what NATO believes is that it is America's nuclear arsenal that is, in fact, in the end, the supreme guarantee of the security of the alliance. This is why America's nuclear policies, its modernization, its capacities matter to the world, its stability, and so forth. Even the 32 nations in Europe and NATO believe that is the case. And they don't pay a dime for that nuclear deterrent. It's all free chicken for them.
Yeah, I mean, as I think about NATO, and you know, this is despite President Trump's rhetoric, you know, because this is one thing people, they want to take him literal when it suits them, and then they want to dismiss him when it suits them. But if you sort of take Trump for what he's, you know, what his intent is, he's, you know, he's right that NATO member states in Europe have largely relied on the United States. And there's a big debate in Canada. I ran across, just sort of by happenstance, internal discussions amongst Canadians about, hey, we have no military capability anymore. We can do nothing. We've allowed it to atrophy. And we really have to do something. And Canada is sort of one of those few countries that still has positive population growth and has a growing economy. And so they have sort of a better option for getting out of this problem than many, you know, NATO member states in Europe do. And it's a challenge for me to see how NATO moves beyond the U.S., because there's a lot of discussion right now, and I was doing some work on an article earlier about the discussions between the British, the French, and the Germans for how could the British and French arsenals become a European arsenal. This is a big topic of discussion right now. And I'm not sure that it can effectively do what would be desired of it for either one of them in regards to deterring the Russians. And so NATO has, I know we're about out of time for the episode, but NATO has you know, it has a storied history. It's been the most successful alliance in the history of mankind. It's been an enduring alliance. It's given, in many respects, it's given nations under sort of American leadership a common language, a more common culture. It's created more unity across Europe than we had ever previously seen. It's done a lot of good things. I'm just concerned about where we are and where we're going, and how do we revitalize NATO in an effective way?
Well, I can't agree with you more. Let me say this though. I'm actually a little less optimistic. Recently on the 9th of April, 2024, Secretary of Defense Austin, testifying before the Senate Armed Services Committee, told Senator Tuberville in a question that the goal is to bring Ukraine into NATO. And I think that is a very profound statement. Because when we look at Ukraine, I like to say that for the same reasons that we probably shouldn't have, that if the Baltics were trying to get into NATO today, I think they would have had a much harder time. Yeah. Because there was such an intricate part of this, of the Russian Union, of the Soviet Empire. Ukraine also has this connection, but they didn't get to come in 2004. They get to come in, or try to come in 2024 or later, definitely later. And this is going to be a challenge, because you are literally poking the bear, and figuratively poking the bear, by saying we are going to bring NATO in. It does not motivate Putin to stop this war if he believes that he is still going to lose and have Ukraine go into NATO and tolerate that. I think we are asking for something that is just maybe a little too much for Putin and Russia to accept. And I don't see how you convince him to do so otherwise after 300,000 plus casualties. A senator also asked the SecDef, how do you define victory in the Ukraine? And this was a little more hopeful. His response was, the Secretary of Defense's response was that if Ukraine remains a sovereign, independent, democratic state with the ability to defend itself and deter aggression. That was his answer. He didn't say to its original borders.
Yes.
And so this is an interesting. So if we're that's probably the key here, right? And if you're going to try to solve this problem going forward, you're going to have to figure that problem out. One final reason why I am a little bit down, a little bit pessimistic on the NATO future with Ukraine specifically, is if Ukraine is allowed into NATO, what are we bringing in? We say that it's a democratic nation, but it's canceled its elections during this war, whereas Russia had their elections. You can make fun of it all you want, but they had an election, and the Donbas region and Crimea voted in that election.
Yeah.
And that's a key factor here. And America had an election. Roosevelt was elected in the middle of World War II, and so forth and so on. We know that Ukraine has a history of corruption, and that's a challenge that NATO is going to have to deal with. And then who pays the bills? Right, the latest UN estimate, $491 billion in critical infrastructure damage that has to be replaced. Another $150 billion in environmental damage that would have to be cleaned up. Are we going to go to Putin and ask for reparations? Or are we going to expect the American and the European taxpayer to repair that while bringing them into NATO?
Yeah.
So I think these are real hard questions, considering the fiscal challenges that already face the alliance. Both individually by state and as an alliance writ large, that they're going to have to figure out. And bringing in this lost puppy and trying to resuscitate it back to life, I think is going to be a bit of a challenge. And we better go into that with our eyes open. If you're trying to avoid a war, this is probably the wrong way to do it.
All right. Well, we'll make that the last word. We could, of course, talk about NATO for hours and hours
and hours.
But we won't. Now, of course, we want to thank you, the listeners, for joining us on this episode of The NIDS View, and we'll encourage you to join us next week. Until then, think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to The NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.